Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to You and Me at 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a new talk show airing on Sunday mornings. I'll be bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. Today's guest is Dr. John R. Winterston, a professor emeritus of environmental history at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. He served as the associate editor for Maryland Historical Magazine for 10 years, a senior fellow at the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian Institute, and a member of the board of directors for the Anacostia Watershed Society. In 2017, the Maryland Humanities Commission selected Dr. Winterston as a Maryland Millennial Scholar, and he received the Maryland Writers Prize for his book, The Oyster Wars of Chesapeake Bay. Dr. Winterston, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Unfortunately, our paths didn't cross while you were teaching at UMES. I arrived around 2010, 2011. How long did you serve at UMES, and how was the experience?
I was a professor at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore from 1972 to 1996. It was one of the most interesting experiences in my life. I had good students, challenging students, living in an environment that outside the campus was often racially oppressive.
Are you a native of the Eastern Shore or the Washington, D.C. area?
No, I'm a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
What brought you to the Eastern Shore?
My wife and I had been working for the University of Maryland in Europe teaching. I was teaching on military bases. And I came back to the United States, and there was a vacancy at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore for which I applied, and I was hired.
Let me ask you this. How did you see the area, the university itself, but then also that area of Princess Anne, grow and evolve during that time period that you were there at the university teaching?
Well, the area was still, from a racial standpoint, pretty hot. I mean, you just had, a while back, the Cambridge riots and H. Rapp Brown and Gloria Richardson in Cambridge. And the university was more or less a kind of encapsulated academic community set in a wider context that wasn't all that friendly. But over time, especially when Bill Hoesch became president of the university, he built a lot of bridges out to the white community, and things began to change and evolve. And also the state legislature began pouring a lot of money into the institution to allow it to grow and develop new programs. But when I first came there, we couldn't even get a new appropriation to build a better swimming pool than the one we had. Many in the legislature said if the students at UMES wanted to go swimming, they could go into the Monocacy River.
Do they have a history program when you arrived at UMES?
Yes, they had a history major, and it was quite viable. And shortly after I left, the history major was terminated. And then one day I received a call from a woman who said that she had been appointed at UMES to teach history, and I was quite surprised. She stopped by the office. Your colleague, her name escapes me at the moment.
Oh, Catherine Barrett Gaines?
Yes, Catherine Gaines. And she told me that the history major had been reinstated, and I was quite happy.
What inspired your interest in environmental history?
Well, when I got down to the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, there were two or three things that really interested me and my wife, and that was, one, writing a history of the institution, which was then, once upon a time, Princess Anne Academy and its evolution over time. Two, to write about racial situations on the Eastern Shore, and three, to write about the environment, because when we came down here in 1972, there was still a very viable waterman's culture. The oyster industry was booming, the crab industry was booming. Crisfield had oyster packing houses. Now all these packing houses have been torn down and condominiums have been built. So I was very interested in the waterfront and waterman's culture, you know. When you go to Texas, you do the history of oil. When you come to the Eastern Shore, you do the history of crabs and oysters.
And speaking of that, as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, you received an award for your book, The Oyster Wars of Chesapeake Bay. Can you just talk a little bit about that book?
Yes, the Oyster Wars of Chesapeake Bay is a book that deals with the conflicts on the bay over oysters between 1860, roughly, and 1952. There was a constant battle between Virginia watermen and Maryland watermen over access to the oyster beds, which in the mid to late 19th century were quite lucrative. Oysters were a very popular consumer item, and you could make a lot of money harvesting oysters. And so there was a lot of conflict on the bay, and many of the watermen armed themselves. And it was so bad that the state legislature had to create an oyster navy, which is now the Maryland State Marine Police. So I wrote about the conflict. And the last shooting on the Chesapeake Bay that I recorded in my book was in 1952, over a dispute between the state of Maryland and some rogue watermen from Colonial Beach, Virginia.
Wait, so you're telling me it was that bad that you had people shooting at each other?
Oh, yes.
So I know you said in the book you cover the time period from 1860 to 1952. So since that time period, how have things improved?
Well, things improved largely because oyster harvest seriously diminished. I mean, at the high tide of the industry in the 1880s, the watermen of the bay took 15 million bushel of oysters out every year. Now, they're lucky to get 300,000-400,000 bushel. So the diminished harvest, the diminished interest in the oysters, and now it's become sort of a niche industry for gourmet restaurants and things of that sort. But once upon a time, oysters were so plentiful that they took the oyster shells and paved roads with them.
So we all inhabit the earth and we interact with the environment. So one might assume that we share a common interest in maintaining a clean and healthy environment. However, not all Americans have access to clean water, nutritious food, or safe neighborhoods. So do you believe that the 21st century Americans are sufficiently aware of the importance of altering their actions to conserve water and limit waste and eliminate pollution and runoff?
Well, one of the things that is so tragic is that the things that are so important to us are used in commons. Back in the 19th century, the Chesapeake Bay was a common, meaning everybody could use the bay, harvest fish and oysters from the bay with impunity. So, too, we regard our air as a common thing. We all want it. Our water as a common thing. We all want to drink it and use it as a common usufruct. But the thing is that some people use it more than others, and some people harm it more than others. And so the tragedy of the commons is when something is out there for use and it doesn't cost them much, people will abuse it. And so we're now coming into an era where it's not only a matter of climate change that we're talking about, but it's a matter of environmental justice. Is our prosperity and our clean air the result of someone else's dirty water and dirty clean air, say, in an underdeveloped world?
Right. And you brought up climate change. And obviously, that's been a really big issue that people have been debating for years. So with this upcoming presidential election, I'm sure we're going to hear this discussed more and more in debates and in town hall meetings. For listeners who may not be familiar with that term climate change, can you just explain what that is?
Yes, it means that the gradual heating up of the world's surface and atmosphere. We're now heating up our world more than 2 degrees centigrade a year, and it means that as our Earth and as our atmosphere warms up, it has effects on the planet in terms of hurricanes, in terms of floods, in terms of droughts. And so our planet is simultaneously getting wetter in certain areas, drier in other areas, hotter in certain areas, and it's something that people are beginning to notice. They hadn't noticed it much before, but they're starting to notice it now.
And when we see all of these various tropical storms and these strange weather patterns, how much of that is related to the climate change?
You know, hurricanes start with hot air blowing off of the Sahara and comes across to the Caribbean and up along the Atlantic coast. And these hurricanes are more and more achieving level 5 status, meaning they're pretty rough customers. And the more the planet heats up, the more the rain and winds begin to blow, the more these air fronts run into cool fronts, the more disturbed the air becomes, and it hits with devastating impact in various parts of the Gulf and along the Florida and Atlantic coast.
It almost seems as though when we talk about climate change that it becomes a partisan debate where you hear folks say that, well, this is the liberals trying to make an issue, make a mountain out of a molehill, or you hear that, well, now the Republicans are getting involved in the climate change debate, or President Trump is getting involved in the climate change debate. And then you'll hear some folks say, well, climate change doesn't really exist. So why do we have these ongoing debates? I mean, is this a political issue in your opinion?
It is a political issue, but it's bigger than just a political issue. It's a big issue of money and power. There's not a whole lot of ideological difference between the Republican Party today and the Democratic Party today, although Democrats would be quick to disagree with me. But by and large, it's a matter of power and money. If you can make a lot of money by processing coal for power plants and things of this sort, naturally you're not going to be in favor of any kind of program to reduce carbon emissions because you are a carbon emitter. And if you have enough money, you can essentially use your power with that money to influence political opinion.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to UMES30. Today's guest is Dr. John R. Winterston, a professor emeritus at UMES and also a noted environmental historian. So, Dr. Winterston, I'm from the Washington, D.C. area. I attend a church in Largo, Maryland. And last September, our young adult ministry group did a community service activity where we went down to the Anacostia River, and it was a Saturday morning, and we removed trash from the river. This is in the southeast Washington, D.C. area. So I know about 10 years ago or so, you published a book called Anacostia, the Death and Life of an American River. In my lifetime, Anacostia has been associated as a majority poor, majority black community in Washington, D.C. So I want to know, is the neglect of the river due to social factors of race, class, local politics, and how can we encourage legislators and public officials to alleviate these environmental injustices that are experienced in some communities, such as Anacostia?
Well, Joshua, it's a big question. I'll try to answer it as best I can. The spoilation or the devastation of the Anacostia River dates all the way back to slavery days in the 17th and 18th century, when planters began to plant tobacco and later wheat, and they just cleared the forest and the rivers and streams began to silt up. Later on, as industries like slaughterhouses and other chemical industries and gas plants and power plants began dumping their leftovers into the river, which were highly toxic, the river began slowly to die. Rivers do die. They lose their oxygen content, which means it's impossible for fish and other wildlife to profit from the river's nutrients. And then along comes the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard, which was dumping a lot of pollutants in. And so by the 1960s, the Anacostia River had become a river that no one wanted to fish in, no one wanted to swim in, and it was a lost river. But there were those people on both sides of the Anacostia River who remembered a better time, a better place for the river, and were unwilling to let it go. In terms of class and race, the main issue is that most of the problematic industries were located in the underprivileged areas of the city, and therefore, whatever happened to the Anacostia had an impact on the people who lived there. Let me give you an illustration. In the 1950s and 1960s, the city of Washington, D.C. developed a plan to build a freeway along the river, the Anacostia, which is now known as Route 295. In order to do this, they had to devastate a large portion of the community of Southeast D.C., which was black. Afro-American responders to this plan said this was nothing more than a device to build highways through black men's bedrooms. And it was a very controversial thing, but it was jammed through because the business community had the power in the city at the time. The city did not have its own autonomy, and the Congress was running the city. And so you have all this exhaust fume that is now coming through on 295, which means that there's a very high incidence of asthma in Ward 7 and 8. There's a very high incidence of cancer in Wards 7 and 8, although people will be quick to say you can't prove that. But why are all these asthma patients coming into hospitals?
You know, that's so interesting that you say that. We're talking about the Washington, D.C. area and what's happening out in Anacostia. And as you're talking, I was having images in my head of Flint, Michigan, and thinking about what was going on out there, the politics and the water and how the folks there were getting sick from the lead poisoning. You know, and then also you're talking about how the freeway was going to be built and that was going to uproot a number of black families. And then I also started thinking about New York City. And I know that there was an issue, I believe, in the 50s and 60s in New York and some of the black communities where they were building, I believe it was the freeway or... And same thing, the families got uprooted. So it's interesting how you see all of these different things playing a role where the business community gets involved and then the politics gets involved. And the poor people oftentimes end up being the ones who suffer. And then, like you say, it also has an impact on the environment, which, you know, could in fact impact the health negatively of those poor people living in those communities. Let's talk a little bit about your newest work or your latest work, Rising Tides, Climate Refugees in the 21st Century. What's that book about, sir?
Well, it's about the fact that by 2050, with climate change, there'll be large numbers of areas that will produce refugees because either they'll be flooded out like in Bangladesh or dried out like in Africa. And 50 million people on the move. I mean, we're upset over the fact that a million refugees are trying to get from Mexico into the United States. Wait till we get confronted with the idea of 50 million refugees moving around the planet. And this becomes a real problem. We don't have a real strategy for dealing with the fact that environmental change produces refugees. And the United Nations Higher Commission on Refugees defines refugee as someone who's fleeing political or military oppression. It does not define as a refugee someone who's fleeing an economic disaster zone. So United Nations has been relatively powerless in terms of dealing with this environmental refugee question. And the more storms, the more floods that we have, the more the problem is going to be readily apparent. We see people trying to get from Libya over to Italy, from Libya to Europe. Why are they fleeing? Because they don't have a choice. They can either stay and die in their own community or starve or go to one of the more developed communities and hopefully get a job. Even if it's cleaning toilets, it's 100% better than that which they experienced in their own country.
Do you hear this point being brought up a lot when we hear these recent debates over immigration and restricting immigration here in the U.S.?
I don't think that the whole question of immigration is being well thought out.
Okay.
There is no such thing as preventing immigration. Immigration happens. And it happens largely because as populations get older, there's a need for younger workers. And if the population is not renewing itself, as in Germany or the United States, where are these workers going to come from? So the idea of stopping all immigration, it's unrealistic. So what you need is a balanced system of immigrant processing that, first of all, should be directed at improving the conditions in the immigrant's homeland so that they're not forced to immigrate in the first place. The second thing that you need to do is to make sure that those people who are immigrating are being processed properly and have the skills and the education necessary for them to survive in a new environment. Being an immigrant is it's a tough experience. You have to learn a new language. You have to adapt to a new culture. These things are not being well thought out. The other thing is that with 50 million people on the loose in the world and by 2050, they bring with them a host of contagions, diseases, pathogens of all kinds, tuberculosis, for example, other diseases. And it's not that they're saying, hey, I want to bring a disease to the United States. It's just part of their being. And so we haven't even begun to think about that.
So, Dr. Winterston, obviously environmental justice is something that's very important to you. You know, I work with young people every day, college-age students, and, you know, I also work with younger folks in high school at my church. What would you say to this younger generation, these millennials and the younger people after them, in terms of what you want them to know about environmental justice and why these issues should be important for them?
Well, first and foremost, I would say that everything is connected. You just can't have the environment, let's say the environment on the one hand, and then justice on the other. The two are interrelated. The important thing is to recognize that there's a kind of symbiotic relationship between justice and the environment that students need to be very much aware of. Anytime a highway is built, anytime a factory is relocated, anytime a shopping mall is contemplated, there has to be factored into the thing. How is this going to impact on the community? What's it going to do to the people who live there? And this gets down to the basic question of power. Power doesn't concede itself lightly. It doesn't concede. The only way that power concedes is if it's confronted by a countervailing power. And in this respect, the one avenue that people who are on the bottom part of the spectrum have is the ballot. People have to vote. You can march, you can demonstrate, but if you don't have the political power, the politicians will ignore you.
Where can listeners find copies of your work?
On Amazon.com. They're all in print. Even Oyster Wars, which is published in 1980, still in print. And incidentally, my most popular book.
Are you working on any new projects right now?
Right now, I'm producing historical documentaries, film documentaries, about between 12 and 15 minutes in length, on the Washington, D.C. waterfront. Just finished one on an architect who redesigned the Georgetown waterfront. And we are now pretty much through production of a film that deals with the evolution of Capitol Hill and the Navy Yard.
When will those be available to view?
The one on the waterfront is currently available on YouTube. And as soon as we get the other one finished, it'll be available on YouTube as well. Doing a film is very expensive, and we're beginning to run out of money. But there are a number of projects that we would like to do. One is on the Ebenezer United Methodist Church on 4th Street, which is one of the oldest churches in the city. And another is to do a short on the Potomac Riverkeeper. These are the people who are going out and seeing all the abuses that take place and reporting them to the authorities. But, you know, the basic question is time and money and age. I'm not a spring chicken anymore, so it's I don't know how much more I can do.
How did you get involved in filmmaking?
When I wrote my book on the Washington waterfront, someone mentioned to me that this would make an excellent venue for short educational films that could be distributed into the public schools. And I said, yeah, that was a great idea. So I went to a filmmaker, and he said, I'll give you the best deal in the world, Jack, because your project is very worthwhile, and people need to learn more about the historical evolution of the waterfront. And I'll do the editing, the filming, and everything else, and I'll cut you the best price. You can't even get a better price from than anybody else in Washington than I'm going to give you. And he quoted me a price of $2,000 a minute. At the time, I had envisioned a 28-minute film, like for the History Channel, and that's $56,000. So we've been doing it on the cheap, getting people to volunteer, getting young filmmakers involved, having people do the narration, working on the script for peanuts. And that's how we're limping along.
Wow, you know, this is really good work that you're doing. And you talk about being an educator. And, you know, obviously with you, education goes beyond just being in a classroom. You've taught at the university level. You've taught at other levels in the classroom setting. And then you've also done your research and turned that into books. And people read those. And you've gone out and you spoke publicly about that research. And now we see you making these documentary films. So, you know, just I would just say can keep up the good work. And you really inspire young educators and young historians like myself to keep pushing, you know, keep pushing ourselves to greater height. I'm definitely interested in a lot of these things that you've been talking about in regards to the waterfront and the Anacostia River and things of that nature. So I want to say thank you so much for joining me this morning. And again, sir, give us the name of the documentary that's on YouTube right now so people could go look for it.
It's called On the Waterfront with Arthur Cotton Moore, M-O-O-R-E.
And like he said, you know, please take care of the environment. We only have one Earth to live in, so let's make the best of it. Thank you again, sir, for joining me.
My pleasure, Joshua.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that has piqued my interest. You and me as engineering students, Kyle Bachman, Robert Perez, Ethan Hitch, Chris Campbell, and Scott Hogan competed against students from 10 other schools in the HBCU M1 Design Competition sponsored by the U.S. Army Combat Capabilities Development Command. The students had to design military drones capable of addressing the following challenges: eliminating wire bundles in an innovative way in small drones, and seeking a way to replace unmanned aerial vehicle parts with biologically based materials. The competition was held last month in the Sun Bowl Stadium at the University of Texas, El Paso. Congratulations to all of those students who competed in the competition, and keep up the good work. Finally, also want to just congratulate students, the undergraduate students, as well as those graduate students who've earned their master's and PhDs and other honors. And obviously, this is a proud moment for all of the parents, the mothers who had to sacrifice, the fathers, the grandparents, the family members and friends who acted as surrogate parents for these students, and also their teachers, mentors, professors, advisors, friends, loved ones, etc. So again, congratulations to everybody who graduated this semester, and pray that you guys have successful futures and that all of the students at UMES have great summers. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again for our guests today. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and other forms of social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day. Please note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.